Russia has struggled in its efforts to build a democratic political system and market economy to replace the social, political, and economic controls of the communist period. While some progress has been made on the economic front, and Russia's management of its windfall oil wealth has improved its financial standing, recent years have seen a re-centralization of power under Vladimir Putin, and democratic institutions remain weak. Russia has severely disabled the Chechen rebel movement, although sporadic violence still occurs throughout the North Caucasus. That CIA summary of Russia today suggests that America's Cold War adversary remains a place of contradictions, with its new wealth and political power still up for grabs. I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
With Russian President Vladimir Putin pulling in the reins of power during his 8 years in office, what's likely to happen when he steps down in 2008? Are relations between the U.S. and Russia deteriorating? Is Russia's new wealth trickling down to improve the standard of living of its people? How free is the Russian press? Our guest is David MacDonald, professor of history at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Welcome back to University of the Year.
Well, thank you for welcoming me and having me. Delighted to be back.
I know in the past you've talked about some of the czars, you know, things from Russia's history. I saw in a recent article Putin referred to as a czar in modern clothes. Would you say that we still in Russia find czarist traditions and things that you can only understand by going back into the past?
I think you can find in Russia not so much a czarist tradition as a tradition that flourished in the last two centuries of czarism, which is a particular understanding of the state, what its role is, what its position is vis-a-vis the population, what its position is vis-a-vis the outside world. And it's a conception of the state that readers of Thomas Hobbes would find familiar, or students of absolutist theory in 17th to 19th century Central Europe, which is that the state is there to act as a unifying center, a mobilizer of resources to defend the country's glory or honor or status abroad, but also to provide certain benefits for its citizens. And what will vary will be, in that context, agents of state power see themselves as particularly positioned and qualified to exercise decisions on behalf of the whole society and for the good of the whole society. And what you'll see change or vary over time is the breadth with which these agents of state power interpret their prerogatives and the degree to which they're willing to concede prerogative to parts of the population. If you talk to Putin himself or read what he has to say, he does not compare himself with any emperors. He compares himself with a figure from my period of Russian history, the late imperial period, Pyotr Arkadyevich Stolypin, the last great reforming leader in the Russian government before World War I, who tried to refashion the strength of the Russian state after defeat in Japan, or at the hands of Japan in 1905, and a revolution that followed course and imposed a constitution of sorts on the Russian autocracy. Stolypin tried to reassert state power in a variety of ways to revitalize and modernize Russia, and I think Putin has chosen well in his models, or has chosen an accurate precursor, but he would not claim, well, for one thing, he has not inherited his power. He is accountable to constituencies in a way that a Russian sovereign and autocrat wasn't, and even more accountable to constituencies than his predecessors in the Soviet government were. But I think there are certain identifiable continuities that have to do with not just Russia's history, but the way regimes have grown from one another, from Tsarist into Soviet and from Soviet into this brave new world.
Would it be generalizing too much to say the concept is still of power from the top down rather than from, let's call it, the electorate up?
I think that is a complicated question. I think that Putin and his defenders would argue that there is probably more genuine popular sovereignty being exercised now than at any time in Russian history, if only because his poll ratings right now, his approval ratings are something like 60 to 70%, depending on the poll you ask. Now, the rub comes in the fact that the same people who favor Putin are almost as suspicious of the current government as their predecessors were of the Soviet bosses of the Nechaystvo. But to the extent that this is a government or a constitutional order of sorts that has been endorsed repeatedly since 1993, the constitutional referendum, presidential elections in 96, new ones in 2000 and 2004, you have as much popular sovereignty at work, however skewed and tainted it might appear to us, you have as much popular sovereignty at work as you have it at any point in Russian history.
When Yeltsin died recently, I realized I forgot he was alive. I mean, I hadn't heard much about him. But what would you say the Yeltsin legacy is, and how has it affected Putin and his concept of himself?
I think Yeltsin is a fascinating and underestimated figure in many ways, that through a couple of decisions that still arouse controversy among Western scholars and certainly among post-Soviet Russians, he effectively barred the door to a relapse to communism, to some sort of counter-coup or counter-revolution in the mid-1990s. He also, in a very shambolic and haphazard and ill-organized fashion, created the conditions for the emergence of this, maybe it's a robber baron private sector, but a private sector that still plays an important role in the Russian economy. And he presided over the negotiation of relationships in the New World Order, and was more effective an advocate of Russian interests in that process than people give him credit for. But most of all, he presided over an extremely conflicted, traumatic transition from a Soviet state that was unraveling, as most people below the age of 70 were willing to recognize, and this new order, the institutions of which had started already to stabilize by 1998 or so, when he makes Yevgeny Primakov his prime minister. So Yeltsin's is going to be a mixed legacy. I think that history will be fairer, more dispassionate about him than many Western observers were during his reign, where they always compared him with Gorbachev, whom they idolized at Yeltsin's expense. But I think you will not be able to write the history of Soviet Union and the Russian Federation from 1985 till 2010 without paying very close attention to Yeltsin's impact, right down to people who are still playing important roles in the Putin government, including Putin himself, whom Yeltsin appointed prime minister about 6 months before he retired.
As long as you've mentioned him, what about somebody who is still alive? That's Gorbachev. What kind of effect does he have on Russian thinking today?
Well, I suppose he ran in the rough equivalent of the primaries. I think it was in 2000. He got slightly less than 4% of the popular vote, which leads me to believe that he has a much larger extended family than we'd previously realized, because Gorbachev enjoys a certain amount of grudging respect, but he's really so attached to the Soviet Union, he's almost become politically irrelevant in the Russian Federation, certainly not in the West, where I think observers and officials and commentators have taken much more seriously his impact on the unraveling. This could have been violent. This could have been there's an excellent book by a guy named Steve Kotkin out at Princeton entitled Armageddon Averted. And part of his discussion is playing thought experiments as to how the Soviet Union could have ended. And there are many very traumatic and destructive ways in which it could have ended. And Gorbachev deserves credit for having, when he failed to revitalize Soviet power, at least recognizing that he had to swallow hard and accept the dismantling of the state he had taken over. So in Russia, Gorbachev is a cipher. Outside of Russia, he benefits from the pecuniary attentions of his former pals and also still has a strong reputation.
And this is a kind of basic question, but can you kind of refresh my memory here on what happened to the sort of former Soviet Union? And, you know, for example, if you look at places like Georgia or Belarus, what kind of relationship do they even have with Russia? Are they completely independent? Is there some sort of a network that remains?
Let's see. Who's completely independent? The Baltic states were the first to tear away. They even started asserting their independence when the Soviet Union still nominally existed. Ukraine, as anybody who followed the Orange Revolution knows, is very independent. The Caucasian states, Armenia, Georgia, Azerbaijan, are also thoroughly independent. After the Soviet Union collapsed, there was this attempt that you see revived from time to time to assert the existence of something called the Commonwealth of Independent States. And the only people who are really interested in participating, as a rule, are Belarus, which is probably outside of a little strip on the eastern bank of Moldova, which is also independent. There's a little sort of pirate state called Transnistria that the Russians maintain loose control over. Outside of that, Belarus is the only one of the traditionally European parts of the old Soviet Union to have any interest in an ongoing relationship of greater amity or greater intimacy with Russia. Central Asian states tend to be more interested, although they've got their own problems, and they're trying to broker their position between the Russian Federation and emerging China market, which, given the resources these states have, is attractive, and also the Americans because of Afghanistan and Iran. Oh, I suppose Belarus, Kazakhstan are the two closest. Armenia, only because of the politics of distance. Armenia is between Turkey and Georgia and Azerbaijan, all of which might have designs on certain parts of Armenia. So the Armenians have an okay relationship with Russia, but the rest of them are more or less hostile. Estonia, Russia's tried to put pressure on, most recently because Estonians wanted to move a memorial to the Red Army that, quote-unquote, liberated Estonia from the Nazis in World War II. Latvia, there have been a lot of frictions because there's a huge population of Russians, many of whom are retirees from the security or armed forces of the Soviet Union, who don't want to become Latvian and want the privileges that go with living in Latvia. Lithuania, not so bad. Ukraine is an extremely complex relationship. The population is split almost down the middle in terms of sympathy for and absolute hostility for the Russian Federation. So the old Soviet Union has become a very complex checkerboard of international relationships, although surprisingly little tampering from the Western powers or little effort by Western powers or by NATO or by the EU to assert some sort of determinative role there beyond the Baltic republics.
Russia still has some resources, what, oil, I suppose, upon which those former states are dependent, though?
Yes, all of them. And Russia is not afraid to, the Russian Federation is not afraid to use the oil pipeline to state its case. I guess last winter and the winter before, as relations became complicated with Georgia over a variety of issues, the pipeline supplying Georgia's petroleum needs inexplicably underwent a breakdown and the oil supply was cut off. Ukraine felt similar pressure directly. Interestingly, Belarus, which is probably the closest ally with the Russian Federation in the old Soviet space, Gazprom, the sort of holding company for state interests in the petroleum industry, got the Russian government to support a claim for back payments of monies owed for oil shipments. And the Belarusians, the government tried to resist and eventually had to give in and cough up, I think it was $500 million from an economy that does not have that much money to spare. So the Russians aren't afraid, like a lot of oil producers, aren't afraid to use that as a lever in international relations and in getting the attention of neighboring powers.
How has that oil windfall affected the man on the street in Russia?
I think it depends on where the person lives, how old they are, and what they do. I think on a macro level, oil's been wonderful. It's helped erase all of Russia's debts to international lenders. It has created new wealth, especially in the capital cities. It has helped the Putin administration consolidate the order that was already taking shape under the late Yeltsin years and to make it, if not appetizing to us, at least normal, and to create an air of normality for the citizenry of the Russian Federation. But this is like a lot of resource economies without very strong legal structures. This has come at the cost of an extraordinary striation of wealth that you get a real stratification. If you're a pensioner living in provincial Russia, things have been crummy for you since 1992, 93, when your bank savings would have been evaporated by a set of political events and inflation, and things haven't gotten much better since. If you're a young person living in the capital cities or able to get out of the provinces, the spinoff of the oil boom has probably created a lot of opportunity for you. We know that young people are becoming more assertive and they're getting higher degrees of expectations, at least educated young people, because there was a mini revolt against the sociology faculty at Moscow State University that led to this Federal Commission of Inquiry and has segued into a thoroughgoing examination of the structure of Russian higher education. So in those ways, well, just like in most places, not as bad as in a place like Nigeria and not as politically engaged a fashion as you see in Venezuela, nonetheless, oil wealth has had a very mixed impact on the Russian Federation. But it's given the Putin government all sorts of resources with which to assert its writ domestically and to assert its writ and reclaim status as a major player abroad.
And how does it affect its relationship to the Mideast, to Iran, to Iraq, and just sort of in general?
I would say that there it's less petroleum resources than the might that has come from them, because Russia is not any longer so dependent on Western sources of aid, and because that part of the world has changed so dramatically in the last 7 years, that has actually proven a very fruitful venue in which the Putin government can claim and assert a role as a major player. With Iran, I don't think the Russian Federation has any interest in seeing the United States become a dominant power in the Middle East for all sorts of reasons, chess type of reasons, international status type of reasons, international strategic reasons. So I think the Putin government has maintained contacts with Iran for use as a potential counterweight to the United States. With Iraq, they've gone from a position of outright opposition to using this as an example of what happens when what they consider American hegemonism goes awry and how it fails to benefit anybody. I think in Moscow, just as in Ankara, in Tehran, in Jerusalem, and in Damascus, I think everybody's keeping an eye on Kurdistan. And I'd be very surprised
because it straddles the Turkish, Iraqi, Syria, Iran. And if they assert their independence as a group, it'll affect all those countries.
Yeah. And so I think the Russians, I haven't seen any evidence of it, but just looking at it as a sports fan, I'd be very surprised if the Russians were not also building relationships there. So the Middle East has represented one area in which, because of old ties, because of a new economic situation vis-a-vis the NATO powers and the United States, Russian leaders have been able to reassert the type of role that their Soviet predecessors played.
What do they have to say about the U.S. role in Afghanistan? That's one place that they've had some experience with.
They have been surprisingly quiet about that. I would love nothing better than to sit at the table, to use a Russian expression, with the Russian generals who were charged with who were tasked with conducting the campaign there. I'm sure they and the British ghosts of the generals of the 19th century would all say something along the lines of, "We told you so," about Afghanistan. But there, surprisingly, there hasn't been much that I've seen anyway in my reading from the Russian side. I think turning to that part of the world, they would probably have to be more concerned with the increasingly warm relationships between Washington and New Delhi and the emergence of India as an increasingly important, not just strategic power, but economic power in South Asia. The Indian government and the Soviet government had for years a very strong cooperative and friendly relationship. If you met Soviets in the old days who spoke English, many of them had learned their English while being posted to India.
Was it that old India-China-Russia game?
Which now is becoming a world important game in ways that the Cold War tended to overshadow. So with Afghanistan, there's probably a little bit of what they call schadenfreude, laughing at other people's misfortunes that are too familiar to you. But there, as well, the Central Asian governments to the north of Afghanistan, in their own increasingly contentious relations with the United States, have served as a surprising buffer to any potential apprehensions one might have for the expansion of American power, that especially the government of Uzbekistan, which hosted all sorts of air bases for American forces after a very bloody conflict between dissidents and government forces on the border with Kyrgyzstan. The United States government condemned the suppression of these dissidents by the Uzbek government, and the Uzbeks disinvited the Americans from being in Uzbekistan. So, again, the complexities of regional politics actually favor Russian interests, particularly because they know the area way better than, far better than American or European diplomats.
More on contemporary Russian politics when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
We want to know what you think. Get in touch with us at WPR.org and click on Listener Feedback. Your comments are important to us. That's WPR.org.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest David McDonald, and our topic, Russia today, and it gets big and complicated very quickly, and we've touched a lot of points on the globe in terms of Russian policy, but what about points that are not so easily pinned down, Islamic radicalism? What has been the Russian experience with that?
Immediately on the morrow of 9/11, Putin was, if not the first, among the first foreign leaders to contact President Bush with the sympathies of his population. What you saw a lot of from the Kremlin and in the Russian press was the Americans are finally understanding what we've been up against for 10 years. And we look at and tend to regard Chechnya as a freedom fighter, national conflict, sort of like the Reagan administration used to characterize the Contras, that these are revolutionaries for democracy. In large parts of Russia, across the political spectrum, the Chechens, people look at Chechnya and they see this as a focal point for channeling money from the same organizations that supported al-Qaeda in Africa and the United States and presumably in the Middle East now. They see Chechnya having been a destination for radical Islamic money and radical Islamic shock troops against Russia. That Putin especially will stress the shared mission between the United States, several of the European powers, and the Russian Federation to try and contain this threat of radical Islam and this worldwide fight against terrorism. They will all differ over strategy and tactics, but this has become a very strong rhetorical claim of commonality by the Putin administration. Interestingly, the Russian government also reminds those of us who are inclined to forget it, that the Russian Federation harbors a large Islamic population. I think I read somewhere that the government of the Russian Federation had applied for membership in one of these multinational Islamic organizations on the basis of the fact that Russia had this huge Islamic population. They would be very high up on the list of Muslim populations in any global listing. But radical Islam and Islam as a whole has always represented a certain flashpoint. And among the population, there is much greater hostility to Islam in some circles than even to Judaism, which is a long-time target of a certain type of Russian populism or Russian nationalism. Islam is even a stronger focus. So radical Islam, in a way, it's a useful point of contact for the Putin government with Western governments.
And how do you see the conflict with Chechnya? I mean, if you look at that region and its history and what's being done, looking at it from both an outsider's point of view and also with a knowledge of Russian history and government, what do you see?
I don't think I'm very hopeful. I don't see any force. This is an arena which since the early 19th century, because of the encroachment of Russian power from the north, but also to a certain degree, Turkish power from the south. This is a region in which conflict, guerre à l'outrance, a conflict for total domination, has been the order of the day, and in which there is no single group, constituency, no matter how much aid they get from outside, especially from Moscow or from elsewhere. There is no group that is able to impose its writ without question sufficiently as to create peace there. And, you know, one other situation that sort of more benign in degree situation that was not like that was Northern Ireland. And in Northern Ireland, there the population's exhaustion and the accords brokered between London and Dublin helped attenuate that. I don't see any hope for anything like that in Chechnya. Plus, a lot of outside powers have different types of interests for keeping that conflict alive.
I don't really understand what it is. It's a province. I mean, how is it that it's... What is Chechnya exactly, and why is there such conflict there?
Chechnya is, and this is one thing on which I'm very inexpert, but Chechnya is a region along the north slope of the Caucasus that if you go from the Black Sea to the Caspian Sea along a certain latitude, you will run into literally dozens, if not 100, ethnic groups, all with their own language, with their own internal social structures, their own interpretation of customary law, their own moral codes. And like Highland peoples the world over, from my ancestors in Scotland to Ethiopia to Corsica to wherever, these people fight like cats and dogs. And Afghanistan is the same thing. And there is a group called Chechens. Chechnya is special in a variety of regards. It was the heart of resistance to Tsarist penetration. The Chechens have a specific language. They hold this territory. They've traditionally lived in this territory that you see on the maps in your newspaper if you're paying attention to these stories. But what makes the Chechen story interesting, gives it pathos, and helps explain the ferocity of the conflicts is the Chechens were one of those peoples whom Stalin identified as traitors to the Soviet Union during World War II. He had them forcibly deported from the Caucasus out to what is now Uzbekistan, where, and they were forbidden to return. The Tatars from the Crimean Peninsula underwent a similar fate, Volga Germans. They were moved en masse at the cost of thousands of lives in the familiar-sounding vehicles of cattle cars, subjected to huge privations, punished, summarily executed. It's a searing trauma in the collective memory or in the national memory of Chechens. And they started coming back increasingly during the thaw, during the Khrushchev years. And this has lent a particular ardor to their cause. And then when the Soviet Union fell apart, there was an old Air Force officer, Johar Dudayev, who managed to rally enough support to create a Chechen Republic. And over the last 14 years, this being 2007, over the last 16 years, there have been alternating periods of cold conflict and very hot conflict. And the Kremlin has spent a lot of money and a lot of forces trying to install the son of a leader who was elected and killed last year. But it's just like the Northern Caucasus. It's very complex, and it's very hard for anybody outside of the players to get a handle on things.
And the Chechens, though, on some occasions have taken that conflict into Russia with what would be called terrorist or guerrilla activities?
Yes, and it depends whom you ask. The Chechens are saying they're just fighting the war that their circumstances demand, right? They haven't much other recourse. To Russians, Chechnya looks like this sink of lawlessness and iniquity where you've got drug dealers, you have slavery, you have international Islamic terrorist money. It is seen as this nest of vipers. And a lot of rank-and-file Russians would be just as happy to see them out of there. But I think in Moscow the feeling is if they give up there, then who's going to be next? And you often hear sentiments to that effect, that Chechnya belongs to the Russian Federation. If we let Chechnya go, who's going to demand to go next?
Well, how about the rest of that federation? I mean, we think of it as consolidated after the collapse of the Soviet Union, but there are how many ethnic groups in Russia proper?
Yeah. Oh, still 142 million people in the Russian Federation, give or take. I'd say easily 100 ethnic groups, and some quite concentrated. The Volga Basin, south and east of Moscow, is very heavily Islamic. Tatars and different Bashkirs, different ethnicities will espouse Islam. But alongside that, you're getting economic and geographical regionalism. The oil-rich Far East is becoming much more of a maverick in domestic politics. The agrarian Red Belt, they used to call it down in the south and western part of the Federation, bordering on Ukraine, tends for all sorts of reasons to be very conservative and to support the nationalist parties or the Communist Party, although there's been a considerable swing over to Putin. But right now, the picture is very different from what it was 10 or 15 years ago. Now, through a variety of legislative measures and some decrees, Putin and Moscow with him has reestablished effective control of the governor's offices around the country. They've managed to start getting reliable tax revenues from areas in the Urals, in the Far East, in Central Siberia that we're not sending taxes to Moscow. The types of separatist or centrifugal forces that my friends in political science used to discuss 10 years ago do not seem nearly as threatening to the Federation now as they did in the 90s.
And if you had to put a label right now on what kind of government and what kind of economy exists in Russia, both in terms of what it says in any constitution and also in terms of its practice,
I think that there's an adjective that attaches to both. One is a managed democracy, and the other
seems like an oxymoron.
Well,
sounds kind of like a Russian term somehow, like from the old Soviet days.
I keep thinking of Karl Rove, but but the other is it'd be a managed private sector, and it all goes back to this idea of the state again. The state stand. You know, if you think of it as a figure, Hobbes used this image of a Leviathan, right? This mighty figure standing above society, protecting it, regulating relations among individuals so that they would not use the violence on each other that made life nasty, brutish, and short, but would rather, out of fear, respect for this specter hulking above it, would use this security to pursue a proper cultivated life as property holders and as consumers of the arts and of each other's products and all the rest of it. These people see the state in related terms, that the state's job, the state being this cadre of professionals and administrators versed in how the economy works, the relationship between political power and intentions and consequences, and that they stand above Russian society, which is divided in terms of class, belonging, ethnicity, gender, regional affiliation, modes of getting of wealth. It's the state's job to provide the conditions for all of these people to thrive in. And out of gratitude for, respect for, and loyalty to the state, understanding that the state is the necessary premise on which their welfare depends, these people will support the state.
With taxes,
but also with advice and political backing. And the most intelligent or educated members of this group will serve as advisors to and consultants with the state, recognizing again the state is this overarching, coordinating, mobilizing, and directing instance. And so, in this way of looking at things, and this could have been Prussia in the 1790s, it could have been Austria in the early 19th century, in a certain way, this is the vision Stolypin had, or Lenin always accused Stolypin of imitating Napoleon III, a good French leader, right, in the 1860s and 1870s. Managing public opinion means you get the degree of assent necessary not just for your legitimation, but these people recognize that in order to compete in the world today, you've got to have support in terms of economic productivity, in terms of demographic policy, right? That the Russian population is going through a demographic crisis and you need people to reproduce, in terms of creating the resource base that the state needs in order to accomplish its tasks abroad. So managed democracy means that you convince the people you've done a good enough job of providing order and the conditions for prosperity that they will entrust you with political decision making.
Key to that would be also the press, though, right?
Absolutely. And there it seems to me they've pursued a fascinating policy because it's one that's much more sophisticated than you see acknowledged in the Western press. There's no doubt that, to use a Leninist phrase, they've seized the commanding heights in the media. TV and almost all radio follows the government's line. And it's all Putin all the time, fair and balanced Putin, whatever you want.
Which it didn't before, so there's been a reversal of
some
kind.
Well, there used to be privately owned networks. The people that privately own them now tend to live in places like London and Tel Aviv and New York and Switzerland. And radio, with some exceptions, is also managed. However, if you go on the internet, or if you're in Moscow, Petersburg, any Russian city with a fair run of papers, there are still press organs, there are still publications that actively contest the government's policy and actively criticize the Putin administration in ways that would have been inconceivable in the Soviet period. Likewise, the internet, Likewise, a couple of radio stations, a very favorite among people, is Mayak in Moscow. The Voice of America has stations over there. There are channels for dissenting voices. However, and I think it's not irrelevant to debates over access, the diversity of opinion in North America or Western Europe, I think the government has calculated, and I'm afraid probably correctly, that most people don't want to hear these dissenting voices. They don't want to tune in to those pointy heads on Mayak, or they don't want to read those eggheads and those chattering classes in Nezavisimaya Gazeta, the independent paper, or in Kommersant, the business paper, which provided remarkable coverage of the Orange Revolution. Most people don't care about them. In a much different vein, there are people who would suggest that the Thatcher and Reagan administrations of the 1980s made a similar gamble, that people would listen to their story, and you just let the intellectuals chatter among themselves because they can't do much harm anyway. And now there will be people who say, not unconvincingly, that at times this isolation of dissonant opinion, while allowing it to continue, is not an entirely ironclad policy. The death of Anna Politkovskaya, a very prominent journalist, very able journalist, who was murdered, many people suggest, not implausibly, that she was a victim of either the government or powerful interests with the government's support who were extremely put out with her ongoing coverage and critical coverage of the war in Chechnya. But for the most part, I go to a couple of websites daily on the internet that are compendia of Russian press outlets. And as somebody who cut his teeth on all this in the 1970s, I'm still blown away by how much latitude of opinion there is.
What about freedom within the arts? I mean, Russian writers have always had that kind of troubled relationship. But at this point, if you're a novelist living in Russia, can you put into fiction pretty much anything you want without being...
Oh, compared to any time since the early 20th century, and Russian literature is not my specialty, but even a sampling of what I can find in bookstores and on the internet, this is a period of pretty incredible vitality. There's no Russian Booker Prize. There's a lot of patronage of the arts, and because I don't think the political power structure is incredibly strongly interested in the arts in the way that their predecessors were, because in a way they're governing against the memory of the old Soviet order. They say we're bringing you prosperity and transparency, although they aren't. The arts, they more or less let go on their own devices. Russian film right now is fascinating. Literature is just exploding because all sorts of emigres who used to write just for each other have now found an audience in Russian Federation as well. And you've got this huge diaspora audience. There, the hand of the government has lain very lightly on the arts.
Who will govern Russia after Putin, and what will be the future of U.S. and Russian relations? Those questions, and probably the answers too, when we return in a moment. This is University of the Year.
At portalwisconsin.org, visitors can navigate content through a variety of means, including searches by keyword, subject area, and date. Content is updated almost daily. Wisconsin Public Radio is pleased to invite you to visit portalwisconsin.org.
Whoever does not miss the Soviet Union has no heart. Whoever wants it back has no brain. Remark attributed to Vladimir Putin. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is David MacDonald, and we're talking about contemporary Russian politics. Putin seems, when you watch him at news conferences, he seems a very kind of dour man, you know, not very smiling. You don't see him getting, you know, dancing around the way Yeltsin did.
Yeah.
Or his personality.
To follow.
Personality seems quite restrained and a little bit inscrutable. What do you see as sort of the likely successor to Putin, and what will happen after him?
There are various scenarios that you see people speculate on, especially in Russia. I don't think Putin's successor will be anybody that Putin doesn't want to succeed him. There's one scenario, because the reason Putin's stepping down is the Russian Constitution mandates a 2-year term maximum for Russian presidents. And right now the presidency is a 4-year term. There have been people who have tried to suggest that you could lengthen the term of the presidency, get a constitutional amendment, and Putin claims not to have any interest in that. However, there are no term limits on the term of the prime minister, right? The leader of the government in the state Duma and related delegations in the state council, the upper house. And so one scenario has it that since the Putin government has constructed at arm's length a party called Unified Russia that dominates, has the plurality of seats in the Duma, there is one scenario where Putin steps down and runs on the Unified Russia list at the same time that his designee is running for president. Now, it seems to me more likely that whoever runs for president will have to have the approval of several constituencies. One is Putin. The other is the Economic Brains Trust in his own chancellery. Another is not so much the armed forces, but the so-called Siloviki, his old, the strong guys or the strength boys. These are people who have backgrounds in the security services, the old KGB and the like, who are very concerned about maintaining domestic stability and order. So it's going to be somebody, whoever succeeds Putin is going to be somebody who espouses the same vision of the state, the same appeals to order, to stability, to economic progress, to this managed, consultative, and patriotic relationship with the population that Putin has perfected. That's the interesting part of the quote about the heart and the brain is Putin reminds us that many Soviets, you know, it's hard for us to imagine because they were our enemies for about half a century. Many Soviets felt a genuine and not ridiculous patriotism for their state, despite all the depredations that Stalin visited on them. It's interesting, a recent poll came out, reported on by a colleague of mine here on campus, a guy named Ted Gerber in the Department of Sociology. A poll came out showing that something like half of Russian school kids today think that Stalin wasn't a bad guy. And so what Putin was saying is that this was something that people genuinely felt for. That even the new Russian Federation makes a big deal out of Victory Day, May the 9th, which commemorates the victory in World War II, a period of enormous sacrifice and national effort by the Soviet population. And I think whoever succeeds Putin, what Putin has sought is grounds for generating an equally productive and widely felt patriotism on the part of the Russian Federation's population. So whoever succeeds him is going to have to be able to appeal to that, you know, and Putin's taciturnity, it's interesting. I think it's his character. He's from a poor background in Petersburg. He wasn't precocious, but very hard worker and made his way up through the ranks in the KGB, not as a torturer or killer, that he was sort of counterintelligence and a forward eyes for the Soviet state in East Berlin.
Probably not smiling a lot, though,
not,
in that
oh,
job.
No, and he's just, that's one attribute. Most Russian statesmen, and almost overwhelmingly men, have this poker face, this dourness that that Emily alluded to. It makes him look seriozny, to use the Russian word, serious. And serious means you take the person seriously. But he does have a sense of humor as well. It doesn't come out in the English press as much. Sometimes in press conferences where it comes across as heavy-handed, but he does call-in shows every year or every 6 months or so within the Russian Federation. And there he can be quite engaging and funny. So I think what he's tried to do is establish a template, even if unconsciously, he has established a template for what a Russian leader looks like. Serious, cultivated, he's a sportsman, he does judo, physically fit, non-self-indulgent, doesn't smoke, doesn't drink, unlike, Yeltsin didn't smoke but did everything else. And I think, in a way, he's become the embodiment of this managerial state. Self-controlled, not cold, but somebody who weighs everything, intellectual without being a pointy head. Again, a serious person. And I think whoever succeeds him, I think there's probably a cohort, a stratum of these people that have similar experiences, a shared vision of what they think Russia should look like, and a confidence in their ability to sell that to enough people to get votes, even without jury rigging.
Like, it would be interesting to know what Russian children are learning in school these days about both history, and you alluded to Stalin as being not so bad a guy in their estimation, but just in general as to what the values are or where the center of their thinking is now.
That's an awfully good question. I couldn't tell you about the children except to tell you that history textbooks are still up in the air. Last week there was an article in the New York Times, I believe it was, talking about the way one proposed textbook treats the Stalin era, and it essentially boils down to, once you get past the millions killed, and the rest of it, he did give us electric lights, and it's fascinating, and it's something, the biggest conundrum for historians, and it's going to be the refashioning of a debate that dominated our scholarship in the last half of the 20th century. Is the way I would put the question is it's almost a counterfactual. What is the effect on the fabric and the development of Russian political life of not having suffered military defeat in the Cold War? And what's the impact of that in terms of continuing to legitimate a certain approach to statecraft that I've talked about? You know, because, well, we talk about democracy, that CIA diagnosis that you talk about, they still show a lack of democratic mechanisms. Being a historian, I'm always very skeptical of this notion that you can somehow airlift democracy into a society, right? That the amount of trust in unseen forces and unseen people that you have to feel to make a democracy work, even among what Churchill called the English-speaking peoples. How long did it take to establish what we take for granted as human rights and an innate democracy, right? Magna Carta 1215, Wars of the Roses, English Civil War, English Revolution, the Glorious Revolution, your guys' revolution, Civil War, Two World War. And it takes until 1965 before every American citizen can exercise her right to vote, right? That's 750 years. And a great deal of conflict. And we're thinking that people who've always worked on these strange networks of very intimate trust that are connected, have always had this very negotiated relationship with a state power. You know, the obverse of the argument of state power that I was giving you is these guys want anything they can get out of us, and the more we can hide and the more we can get them to leave us alone, the better. Right? And this is dwellers in urban communal apartments in the 20th century. This is peasants in the 16th century thinking of Tsarist tax collectors. How do you get from that to relationships where law means something because you know it's going to be exercised relatively impartially, that when decisions are made, they're going to be implemented and implemented relatively impartially? So from all those points of view, thinking about democracy, thinking about where this country is going to evolve, and then just closing the circle, remembering that Germany had governments like this, more or less vicious, right, or more or less authoritarian and centralized, until the Allied powers, including the Soviet Union, or particularly the Soviet Union, smashed, annihilated the Nazi state and held the German population in thrall for how long, right, until 1991 from a certain point of view. From that point of view, it's interesting to think what has been the impact on this country, on the Russian Federation, that we say lost the Cold War. What's been the impact on them for not having suffered military defeat? And one thing that one might want to suggest is that it has legitimated this relationship that is giving us such pause, you know, this failure of democracy.
Well, what misconceptions do you think most Americans have, besides perhaps not understanding the different concept of the state that Russians have? But what else do you think, maybe if we impose our own ideas or our own lack of knowledge about Russia, what gets in the way of our understanding what's going on?
Well, I think it's related to that. I think the biggest misconception is that we think, and all of us subscribe one way or another to a story that Adam Smith first told in the 18th century, that the rule of law came about because people trading and exchanging utilities created these larger networks of shared interest, and he walks us through how you get from feudal to sort of what we'd now call bourgeois democratic rule, and that once people engage in commerce with one another, they're almost automatically, through the operation of their mutual humanity and sense of shared interest, they almost become law-abiding, right? And that's how you get the triumph of the middle classes and that over the barons. Places like Russia, China, up until recently Chile, up until recently Korea, show us that that ain't necessarily so. We thought that when the Soviet Union collapsed and McDonald's went up on Pushkin Square in Moscow, that boom, the scales would fall from their eyes and they would recognize the error of their ways and the irrefutability of ours. And then they would become like us. And it hasn't worked out like that. And our failure to understand that there are alternative stories out there, and that even when Adam Smith was telling his story, there were people in Berlin and Vienna and in St. Petersburg and even in Paris, telling a very different story. Ultimately, our biggest problem is we expect everybody to be like us. And it would be nice if they were. We live in incredibly prosperous societies. We enjoy a great deal of liberty and latitude. And I think our societies enjoy great advantages because of these things. But they aren't automatic. And we tend to think these things are automatic and self-evident. We aren't very good at thinking our way into the experience and into the worldview of people who don't look at the world like us. We tend to think they're perverse. Now, they think the same of us, but if we're going to conduct policies that get the ends we want them to achieve, I think it behooves us to at least try and think our way into what it looks like over there.
Be a little bit more sympatichny.
The
future of U.S.-Russian relations, are we on a downslide now?
No, I don't think so. I think we're in a period of mutual accommodation. I think the 1990s was, what is it, Emily, you'll know that, is it the Wordsworth phrase, oh, to be alive in that...
Bliss was it in that dawn to be alive.
Yeah. To be young, very heaven.
Yeah, this and the sense of emotional access and exaltation and possibility, right, with the end of the Cold War. And I think the Russians realized that sooner than the Americans, because the Russians in some ways were the victims of it, politics goes on. And we've seen the crystallization of, indeed, a new world order, one that is much more complex. And because of the complexity, you can never get the bipolar showdown that the Cold War represented. And the other thing is, thinking sort of the Adam Smith story, is that what's changed now, too, is a Russian government that used to be into, there's an old Leninist phrase, kto kogo, who whom, right? Who's going to be predominant? And thought of things purely in these very reduced vectors. The Russian appreciation of power, its getting, its possibilities, is much more sophisticated. They understand the utility of international economic policy. They understand the different types of ties and relationships you can develop, not just military assistance, but other types of things. There are too many lines of interest out there to have the type of confrontation that you used to have between the United States and the Russian Federation. There are going to be areas where they cooperate, which would be against militant Islam, as you brought up earlier, but other security issues in South Asia, in the Far East, the United States and the Russian Federation have shared interests. There are going to be areas where they compete over the dynamism of the European Union, over American policy in the Middle East. But things have become too complicated, too multilateral now, with China emerging, India appearing to be on the emergent, the continued ability of different types of governments in the Middle East to dictate their way of looking at things because they hold on to this strange liquid that we all need so much, that it's a much more complex world than it used to be. And because of that, you get people talking this way. Let's also remember that a lot of the people who say, oh, we could be sliding into a new Cold War, there's more than a little nostalgia in that, right? The world was easier to understand.
So much simpler, yes.
And a lot of my colleagues or a lot of fellow experts in Russia made a lot of social and material capital out of their ability to parse the workings of this bipolar world. It was simpler then and better for our profession. So I'm not nearly as pessimistic, and I think that both sides have hardened enough politicians to recognize that it isn't black or white, that diplomacy is all about negotiating these areas in the gray.
David MacDonald, thanks for being our guest this hour.
Always a pleasure.
I'm Emily Auerbach with Norman Gilliland, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year. Thank you.